Kansas City is getting the once-over this week from members of the Republican National Committee. We're in town to see whether we have what it takes to host the party's 2016 National Convention. The last convention here came in 1976, and it was a hummer. A candidate named Ronald Reagan was taking on the incumbent president, Gerald Ford, and the battle went down to convention week. I'm Monroe Dodd, and on today's Central Standard, we'll talk with Bill Lacey, director of the Dole Institute in Lawrence, about that convention, so important to Kansas City, and to a man named Bob Dole. We'll also talk about other conventions he has seen as a behind-the-scenes guy in national politics, and we'll ask, in today's world, how much do political conventions even matter? That's ahead on Central Standard, after the news. Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Monroe Dodd. 38 years ago this August, the Republican Party held its national convention in Kansas City. And just this week, members of the party's national committee came to town to scout us out as a potential site for their convention in 2016. Kansas City is different from the way it was in 1976, and national conventions are different animals too. Back then, the eventual nominee, Gerald Ford, had to fend off a convention week challenge from Ronald Reagan. Today, conventions rarely have that kind of drama. We'll talk about that convention in 1976 and about how the whole process of nominating a president has changed since the 1970s. With us is Bill Lacey, director of the Robert J. Dole Institute at the University of Kansas in Lawrence and a longtime toiler in the fields of national politics. He worked in the campaigns of President Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and yes, Bob Dole. Bill, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Let's begin with a name that's on the institute that you direct, Bob Dole. As it turned out, he played a pretty big role in that 76 convention.
He really did. He's a remarkable guy. 1976, he had just gone through the most important campaign of his career, which was his 1974 campaign with Congressman Bill Roy, who just passed recently. He was a great guy, and we got to know him pretty well at the Dole Institute. But he had gone through that campaign, a very difficult campaign, and then he was selected to be President Ford's running mate at the convention. And there's a variety of different stories on it, Monroe, but one of the stories is that that President Ford tried to get then-Governor Reagan to run with him on the ticket, and that Governor Reagan really didn't want to do that. He really saw that he had missed his opportunity in 76, thought he might get a chance later. And President Ford said, well, who do you think would be good? And Reagan just kind of started ticking off people that might be good, and Dole was one of those people. And so eventually they selected Senator Dole, and he was the running mate, and that's the rest is history.
Well, that was the first Republican convention since all the tumult of the Watergate, Richard Nixon's resignation, Gerald Ford's becoming president without having been elected in the first place. Take us back, if you will, kind of set the context of those times, that era, for what went on in the political world of 1976.
Yeah, it was a very challenging time for Republicans. As you note, you'd had the Watergate episode taking place. You'd had an absolute wholesale catastrophic midterm election in 1974 for Republicans. President Ford's term had not gone. His 2 years had not gone especially well. He had not been seen as particularly strong or anything. So it was a very challenging time. And so then-Governor Reagan decided to run against President Ford for the Republican nomination. And it started out in a very one-sided way with the president winning virtually all the contests and then going into the North Carolina primary, and it was in the late spring, I believe, Governor Reagan won a huge and completely unanticipated victory and went on a string of huge wins to the point that I remember actually Rogers Morton, who was the chairman of the president's reelection campaign, somebody said, well, are you going to change your strategy? I think this was after Texas, after Reagan completely swept Texas, and Rogers Morton said, well, there's no reason to rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic, which got him in a lot of hot water with the people. But eventually the president prevailed, And one of the real interesting side notes is that one of the key people involved in his campaign was Stuart Spencer, a consultant and strategist from California who had worked with Governor Reagan's campaign and actually later worked with President Reagan's campaigns in 80 and 84. But going into that 76 campaign, the Republican Party was in disarray. The 76 race kind of represented a fight for the heart and soul of the Republican Party. It followed Watergate. And it's actually remarkable in light of what happened at Watergate that President Ford was able to really close the gap on then-Governor Carter and make it very, very, very close at the end of that election.
Why was Gerald Ford thought by Ronald Reagan to even be vulnerable that year?
I think it was maybe not a thought that he was all that vulnerable as much as it was a philosophical, a belief that there was a distinct philosophical difference between the two men, that Reagan offered a very kind of a modern conservative perspective, that Ford was more of a traditional Republican centrist, and that some of those issues needed to come out. But it was a variety of things, a variety of different issues that brought Reagan out and made him want to challenge Ford. And in the end, obviously, you could say history probably says that Ford won the battle, but Reagan won the war.
And it came down to the convention hall, Kemper Arena, that year, down in the West Bottoms of Kansas City. And it was just about the last time that kind of thing has happened in any political convention.
You nailed that exactly. It was the last time. There has not been a convention by either party since 1976 in Kansas City, when the nomination was really up for grabs when you started the convention in 1976. If we go back there, Ford had a pretty strong block of delegates, but there were all kinds of interesting things that Governor Reagan did to try to shake things up. He named, and this was one of the first time. Normally today, it's in recent history, in contemporary history, it's completely common for a presidential candidate to name his or her vice presidential candidate before the convention. Mm-hmm. Back then, it was traditional to name that person at the convention. But Governor Reagan named Senator Richard Swiker of Pennsylvania as his running mate before that convention started in an effort to shake things up.
Uh-huh.
And then also the second thing that the Reagan forces did, they tried to free up Ford delegates from their pledges to vote for President Ford. He had won some primaries where Reagan people had been elected as the delegates, but they were pledged to support the winner, who in that case was Ford.
Uh-huh.
And they actually had a move on the floor to try to free that up to say all the delegates can vote their conviction as opposed to who they're supposed to vote for based on primaries. They lost that vote, and that effectively was the end of that convention, and President Ford was nominated.
In 1976, what did Americans know about Ronald Reagan? He obviously hadn't been president yet.
He hadn't been president, but, you know, as opposed to today, when you have, you know, one of the other really famous conventions the Democratic Convention in 2004, when then State Senator Barack Obama goes and gives the keynote speech and all of a sudden is a household name.
Mm-hmm.
Contrary to that kind of fast rise that you see in politics today, Ronald Reagan had been around a long time. He'd been on the GE show. He had made an appearance on national TV on behalf of Barry Goldwater in the 64 campaign. He had been governor of California two terms. He actually had, a lot of people don't remember this, but he actually had thrown his hat into the ring right before the 1968 Republican convention.
Mm-hmm.
And was active in it and ultimately really received very few votes other than the delegates from California. But he had that kind of national exposure going into 76 and actually was pretty well known for the time compared to most presidential candidates, you know, when they kind of throw their hat in the ring today.
I'm going to throw this at you as a what if, a hypothetical. You can declaim against it all you want, if you want. But if Ronald Reagan had won that nomination in 1976, would he have beaten Jimmy Carter, do you think, or not?
Wow, that's a really tough question. I haven't given that a lot of thought. I think in the end, it's very hard to say. That race was so, so close, and I can't recall. There are historians out there who could, but I can't recall the exact numbers. But if a very small numbers, we're talking of less than tens of thousands of votes had shifted in Ohio, Gerald Ford would have won that presidential campaign. It really was that close. Reagan might have been able to close that gap. It's really hard to say, but I would prefer to take the long view that what happened was kind of part of fate, that Ford was a nominee, that Carter was a Democratic nominee, and that that was a perfect setup for Reagan in 1980.
Our research department here at Central Standard reports that Carter won 297 votes to Ford's 240. That's in the Electoral College, of course. Mm-hmm. And that can sometimes distort, of course, how close the popular vote can be. Because we know in, four years later, Ronald Reagan did beat Jimmy Carter.
Yes, and convincingly, actually.
Mm-hmm. Now, if Reagan had won that nomination but lost to Carter, again, hypothetical, you think he would have tried again in 1980? He'd been persistent about this.
Yeah, I do. I think he would have tried in 80. I think he would have felt that 80 was more his time. But I also think there's something that comes into play here on the Republican side of the aisle that doesn't come into play on the Democratic side of the aisle. That is, on our side of the aisle, we typically look for a candidate who has been around the track before, who's run before, who has kind of a track record of having sought the presidency, whether it be, Nixon, Reagan, you had Dole, Bush 41, all those guys, McCain, Romney, they've all been around the track before. And so I think he probably would have run and would have been a very strong contender. I think it probably worked politically to his advantage to have not won the nomination, mm-hmm. To have gone up in Kansas City at the convention at the behest of President Ford and given that brief speech that he gave at the convention. That really made, I think, probably a lot of delegates say, we just nominated the wrong person for president. And that probably set him up for 80 in a very dramatic way.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd here with Bill Lacey of the Dole Institute in Lawrence. We're talking about conventions, and particularly about the one here back in 1976. At that convention, The announcement, as you mentioned, Bill, wasn't made of the vice president beforehand. Well, at least Gerald Ford's vice president wasn't known. Reagan had already announced that he was going to go with Schweiker. You mentioned earlier that Reagan had Dole on his list. Why did Ford choose Dole? Were there other reasons?
I think he felt that Dole was philosophically compatible with him. I think he felt that Senator Dole had just been through a very, very tough U.S. Senate race and would be a tough fighter and competitor, somebody with a lot of energy. He clearly was a veteran who had been severely injured, in World War II. I think all those factors played into his hands. And it wasn't kind of a traditional geographic balance, because one doesn't see a lot of balance between, geographically between Michigan and Kansas, really. Both would be considered Midwest, one upper, one lower. But I think those are largely the reasons he selected Senator Dole. And the fact that Reagan actually said Bob Dole would be a good choice. I think that was one of the other things that the Ford campaign operated on immediately coming out of the convention, is that their belief that they needed to solidify their base, that they needed to make sure the very first thing that they did is to get the Reagan people on board, and that by naming someone that was acceptable to Governor Reagan, they should be able to lock in that vote.
Had Dole lined up with either of those two candidates before that convention?
I honestly don't know. I don't believe that he had, but I can't say.
In those days, I think more so than now, there were more Republican moderates. And so Reagan represented a conservative branch that had first made a lot of noise, I guess, with Barry Goldwater, and now was coming up into sort of an equal standing. That was the case then, right? And mm-hmm. General Ford was from the more moderate side.
He was considered more of a centrist, yes.
Mm-hmm. And one of the big changes, it would seem, to an observer in the Republican Party since then, is that Reagan had established it as more conservative than it had been. Is that wise to say?
Yeah, I think that's very acceptable to say now. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, it's interesting, Monroe, I have a lot of people who say to me, well, geez, I wish the Republican Party today had more moderates like Bob Dole. And I look at him and I say, wait a minute, Bob Dole is not a moderate. And as a matter of fact, he's gone out of his way in the last couple years to call himself a conservative. He had a very conservative voting record pretty consistently. But he was always looking out for people who couldn't look out for themselves. And he was always moderate in tone, especially towards the other party, especially when he felt there was a way to find common ground on a very difficult problem. But yeah, I think President Reagan kind of pulled the Republican Party a little bit to the right. And I think that what he did is he kind of built on the coalition that Goldwater and Nixon had started, mm-hmm. and really created an opportunity for the country to have, you know, what one could argue was center-right government from 1980 to 2008. It's a long period of time.
These days, the vice presidential nomination still seems like a bit of a last-minute hurry-up affair, even if it's announced before. You had experience in Bush 41 with the vice presidential nomination that sent everybody wondering, who's this guy?
Yeah, that was probably one of the more interesting things I got to witness at a national convention in 1988, after Senator Dole withdrew from the nomination fight with then-Vice President Bush. Lee Atwater, who I'd worked with at the White House, who was running the Bush campaign, called me up and said, we'd like you to take a big role in the general election campaign. And eventually I was assigned to do California, and so I was working the floor at that convention in the California delegation. And we didn't know, because the vice president had not announced it yet, who the vice presidential candidate was going to be. And finally, after a series of meetings and discussions, it was announced that Senator Dan Quayle of Indiana was going to be the Republican vice presidential contender. And I recall sitting in a meeting before we were about to go on the floor now. This is a day, and I forget which day it would be at the National Convention. Convention was in New Orleans. And I recall sitting in a staff meeting, a floor meeting, of the people who are responsible, basically the floor whips, the people that you see usually wearing baseball caps on the floor of a convention with walkie-talkies, radios, who are responsible for informing delegates of what's going on, kind of giving them guidance on how they're supposed to act and vote on certain issues and those kinds of things. And we were sitting there, and our research director of the campaign is reading out of the Almanac of American Politics about Senator Dan Quayle. And the Almanac, for those of you who don't know, is like a 600-page compendium of every representative and senator in the United States, every governor, all kinds of interesting info. But we had no info on him. It was a complete shock and a complete surprise. And in retrospect, not necessarily the selection of Senator Quayle was a mistake, but the way it was done and the way it was allowed to linger into the convention and to happen the way it did was probably not very prudent. But in the end, it didn't really cost then Vice President Bush any support.
All the scurrying around at the last minute, even with Dole's selection, I don't know when Gerald Ford really started looking at him closely, but it's as if in 1976 this was just in a matter of days with a lot of other hurly-burly going on around him. And you see other choices that all seem to come up at the last minute. How does this affect the quality of a person who could be president of the United States?
Well, I think it's what it's done. Well, it clearly put you in a position where you're making a decision on the spur of the moment, which you probably don't want to make. I mean, that's a big, big choice. When a presidential candidate selects a vice presidential candidate, they're going to look at three main factors. Number one, is this person ready to be president, and will they be perceived as being ready to be president by the voters? Mm-hmm. Number two, do they add some sort of balance in a traditional sense to the ticket? Do they add a philosophical balance or a regional balance? Or, for example, in the case of Vice President Mondale in 1984 and John McCain in 2008, a gender balance. So they look at those factors. And the third thing that they typically look at is, you know, what kind of electoral votes can this individual bring to the table and can they deliver? And, you know, it doesn't take a lot of time to figure out the electoral vote piece. It doesn't take a whole lot of time to figure out the balance piece of it, because that's pretty obvious on the surface. But really what it takes a lot of time to do is to vet the person and to make sure that that the nominee feels that they're ready to be president, should that be required, and to make sure that they're perceived by the media and the voters as being ready. And so what you've seen over the years is that we have gotten away from the way dole or quail were selected at those conventions to the point where now the vetting process starts much earlier. Candidates tend to secure their nominations earlier in the primary process, the nominating process. They tend to go through a very detailed vetting process, and they tend to announce their vice presidential nominees before their convention. Typically, that was something you saved for the convention because it was a big deal. Now it's something that you try to get done before the convention so the convention can focus more on whatever your message is going to be for that election campaign.
Kansas City is one of the four finalists this year for the Republican convention in 2016. What makes Kansas City a potential site in this day and age?
Well, there's going to be different perspectives on that. I think the fact that it's in the middle of the country, the fact that we have the Sprint Center here and it's available at the times that the convention would be held, that is a huge, huge plus. The fact that there's enough hotel rooms, kind of the logistics. But I think, the thing that I see, Monroe, is a symbolism. There's just enormous symbolism going back to 76 that they can talk about. It was, as we spoke about before, it was the last contested convention on either side of the aisle, first of all. Secondly, that convention with the speech that then-Governor Reagan, who lost, and we talked about his losing, but with his speech that he made at that convention, that kind of gave a new emphasis and kind of, in a way, a new launch to his career. And he wound up being arguably the second most popular president of the last century. So that was huge. The third thing that is so symbolic about Kansas City and why Republicans should pick Kansas City is the connection to Bob Dole. Now, we all know that Kansas City is in Missouri and Bob Dole is from Kansas. But those of us who live in Kansas and in Johnson County, for example, I consider myself Metro Kansas City. I don't think of Kansas City as being two cities. I know it is, but I don't think of it that way. And I think America thinks of Kansas City as being one city. And the fact that not only Bob Dole is from Kansas, but that he was nominated to be the vice president in 1976, I think is just a very important symbol. And the fact that, today on the 70th anniversary of D-Day, that Senator Dole is being written up in Politico, that he published a piece in the Washington Post about D-Day, that he's kind of become the symbol of World War II among our political leaders. And I think the symbolism in coming back to Kansas City would be enormous. And then the final thing, not as important as the other three, is just the fact that it was in Kansas City where we had one of these very early situations where the presidential nominee selected the VP early, kind of set a precedent that wasn't followed consistently until later on, but then started to be followed when President Clinton, then Governor Clinton, named Senator Al Gore to be his running mate, when Senator Obama named Senator Joe Biden to be his running mate. You take it, since then, you see that most of the running mates were not announced at the convention, but they were announced before that. So that's an interesting historical connection as well.
I got to take a step back to a phrase you use called working the floor. It can mean a lot of things. I think you kind of, you explained it. There's guys out there with radios or walkie-talkies or whatever the technology is constantly. What are they doing with the delegates?
Well, it depends. In recent memory, in all the conventions that I ever worked, it was really kind of working the delegates, letting them know, okay, we need a big demonstration now. We need you to be very actively involved and supported. If there is a vote being taken and if the presidential candidate or the party have a position of the vote, informing folks of that vote and asking them to consider voting that way. Back in the old days, though, back in 76, for example, which is a convention I didn't work in, but I got to witness on TV very closely. That was the purpose was to try to talk people to vote, for your guy. I mean, it was really hand-to-hand combat at that point. And you had the Ford people on the floor. You had the Reagan people on the floor. You had, you know, the vote that I mentioned. I can't remember the name of the vote, but where they tried to free up the Ford delegates, those kinds of things were going on all the time. And people were really, really trying to convince and cajole people to vote in their direction.
Muscling into each other on the floor.
Exactly.
Competition was a thing. Well, we'll be back after our break to talk more with Bill Lacey about convention cities. If you want to join us after that, please do. If you remember the 76 convention, you got some questions about it, here's your guy. You can call us at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. I'm Munro Dodd, and you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Munro Dodd. With us today is Bill Lacey, director of the Dole Institute at the University of Kansas in Lawrence. We're talking about the last convention where the nominee was actually decided. That was in 76, right here in Kansas City. And we're also talking about the whole matter of conventions and the cities where they take place, how the presidential election works, and so on. We're going as far afield as we can today, I think. If you want to call us and join this conversation, you can. Call us at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can tweet us at KCURCST. And now let's talk, if we can, about the timing of the convention. The talk this year, Bill, is that Kansas City has a bit of an advantage because it has free dates in June, no possibility of an NBA team taking the place. June is awfully early for a nominating convention, it seems. What is the logic in the continual forward movement in the year of the whole nominating process?
Yeah, there's a couple of very specific things, Munro, that that the timing affects. Number one, it just affects kind of the ebb and flow of the campaign. Until the convention, it's really hard to get into the general election. The convention is supposed to lay out the themes for the general election. It's supposed to kind of be the big setup. It's the set piece going into the general election that gets everybody focused on the choice that they have to make and prepares everybody for that. So that's part of it. The most significant part, though, is the way that our campaign finance law works is the election is split between the nominating process and the general election process. And so if you are, for example, less significant in 2016 than it would be in many years, but if you have an incumbent president, the incumbent president who does not have a nominating fight has a distinct advantage. So if you go back to 2012, one of the advantages that President Obama had over Governor Romney is that while Governor Romney was out slogging through the trenches in New Hampshire and Iowa and other states and spending all of his time, all of his money, literally all of his resources on the effort to secure the Republican nomination, the president was able to sit back to organize in those key states where he organized such an incredible ground game and to wait until Romney was a nominee. And then once Romney was a nominee, the president had a period between then the convention where he was able to utilize a tremendous financial advantage because he was able to spend money from the primary phase, whereas Romney was going to have to wait until the general election phase to be able to raise that kind of big money. And so there's a distinct difference because of the election law in when you can spend money you know, what cycle it's for. There's a distinction between the nominating cycle and the general election cycle, and that's a big reason to make that change. That won't be in effect until 2016 per se. But for example, the way the Republicans are probably looking at this, if you go with what is widely perceived as conventional wisdom, we don't know if it'll be true or not, but it is conventional wisdom that Secretary Clinton will be the Democratic nominee, that she probably will win that nomination with relatively little difficulty, probably become the nominee pretty early in the process, you're likely to have a Republican process that goes on longer than that. And so what they're thinking is that by potentially moving the convention up, they put the party and the party's nominee in a position where they're able to move immediately from the nominating process into raising money for that second cycle or spending the money they've already raised for that second cycle that they can't actually start spending until after the convention, which is where the candidate gets his or her official nomination.
And they're raising all that money to use much of it, so much of it, in the media to persuade voters to go their way. On the other end of this equation, do the voters, is there any danger that boredom sets in or tedium or something on the view of the voters of, gosh, this campaign has been going on so long? I speak from personal experience.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would absolutely agree with you on that. But the fact of the matter is, and I wish I remember the name of the political scientist who wrote the book many years ago about the permanent campaign. We're in a permanent campaign now, and people do get tired of it. They don't turn on as early. If you're a partisan, you focus on it much earlier than if you're more of an independent or more of a swing voter. So, yeah, you do run that risk. But if you look, for example, at the president's campaign in 2012, and this reflects his campaign in 2008 as well, sometimes I think they don't get enough credit, the folks who ran his campaign, for the amazing nature of both those elections, both very historical. But 2012 was historical in the sense that the president was reelected despite economic figures that had never allowed any president to be reelected before. And he did that fairly simple. He changed the traditional rules of presidential campaigns. He went into 17 or 18 target states, swing states, around the country. He targeted constituencies that were very important to his reelection, and he made sure that they participated in the election in disproportionate shares in what they normally would if not motivated to do so. And it was really a very different approach. And so in that case, there were huge sums of money in the president's campaign that were devoted to that, what we call the ground game, the voter identification, the voter motivation, the voter turnout program. So I think you're going to see an increasing emphasis on that because our politics is really focused in and contracted to maybe 17 states where they're likely to go one way or the other in today's highly polarized state. It's not at all like 1984 when I was involved in President Reagan's reelection campaign, and we won 49 out of 50 states. That's not going to happen in today's political environment. Someday maybe we'll get back to that, but not in 2016.
Just for curiosity, in those swing states, how big is the group of voters that is even open to persuasion? Is it a big group, small group?
It can be a fairly small group, and which goes back to the genius of the way that the president's folks organized the last two campaigns. And everybody needs to understand, I'm a Republican. I believe that Republicans up to 2008 ran the best campaigns for president. I was involved in seven of those and got to kind of see how things were done. I think that changed in 2008. I think the way that they organized their ground game, knowing that in those 17 or 18 states, that it was a relatively small portion of the voters who could swing things. And then going out and basically what they did is they recruited individuals who typically might not vote. And they went to specific demographics, specific targets that were supportive of the president but still might not vote. And they gave them reasons, compelling reasons to vote. And they got them out to participate. And if you look at the exit polls from the 2012 election, it is clear that the president's campaign completely altered in some of those states the normal makeup of that electorate that you deal with, whether it be by early voting, by voting by mail, or just by turning out on election day. So you have that in play as well.
1976, we've already mentioned, was the last time that there was any kind of floor fight. But even before that, many a convention, as I recall, I think since 1960 when Kennedy won, had gone by without much of a floor fight. You mentioned that Reagan made a little bit of a push in 68 against Nixon and so forth. The 1970s were the era when the primaries really took over and made an important role in presidential elections. Before that, nominations were more controlled by political insiders, weren't they? Parties?
Yeah.
How did that operate that's different from today?
Well, I think that largely this is a very positive change. It basically means that average voters now are having a lot more influence on who their nominee is. If they take advantage of that, unfortunately, a lot of people don't take advantage of that in either party. But Back in the day, it used to be that, you know, the kingmakers would basically decide that, that people would have, you know, a certain amount of pocket of delegates, that you would go to, like, the mayor of a big city machine or something, or or a state that had a lot of power. You would, you know, recruit the governor of the state, the mayor of a city, recruit individuals who had an enormous patronage below them, and you'd get them on your side. And by getting them on your side, you guaranteed yourself a block of delegates. That's completely gone by the wayside, by and large, now to the point where, you know, voters get to elect, get to select who their nominee is going to be.
And that process, too, is occurring so early in the year. You can look back at old newspapers of 1968 when the New Hampshire primary was taking place, and it wasn't taking place in January, and there was no Iowa caucus anybody noticed back then. Is that a good or bad thing?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure that it is a good or bad thing. From a from a political strategist's point of view, you kind of look at the playing field, you kind of understand what the rules are, what you got to deal with, and you deal with it. I think that by and large, the reason that you see this moving up process is you've had this continual over a period of time fight between states that want to be early, that want to have more impact. You look at California, which traditionally has had its primary in June, and I believe they moved their presidential primary up to March, but I'm not 100% sure of that. But only in presidential years, they just recently had their June primary. You look at huge states like that that are occurring so late in the process that they don't feel that they have the influence that, say, an Iowa or New Hampshire, which are relatively small states by comparison, have. So that's why there's been this kind of surge front-loading of primaries that's occurred over the last 20 or 30 years.
And a diminishment in the role of the delegates to the convention. At the same time.
Yes. Delegates are no longer really selecting a nominee, per se. They're really kind of attending, participating. To a certain extent, that you have contested primary, platform planks, which you usually have in each party, one or two a year, where there's kind of a big fight over a particular a plank of the platform. There the delegates' votes and their views come heavily into play, but by and large anymore, unlike 1976 in Kansas City, the people who are selected are going there to hear the speeches, to cheer on who they feel are the good guys, and to you know, have a good time and to enjoy themselves.
I think I've heard people say that conventions now are mostly like 3 or 4 day infomercials.
I think that's probably true. And they're not as important as they used to be because of the volume of coverage that all the candidates get. But they still represent, and this is true even today, they still represent the best opportunity for a party to present its leadership, its message, in a way that is fairly under their control, as opposed to be under the control of the news media. And that really is the distinction about conventions that still is viable and very important today.
And I guess, obviously, people are watching still.
A fair number of people are watching, and the media is covering them very heavily. Increasingly, it's funny because increasingly you see less coverage from the floor and more talking head coverage of what's being said on the floor. I know that that in our household, we will have a tendency to go to C-SPAN to see a national convention, because at C-SPAN you can see exactly what's being said on the floor rather than having four talking heads and an anchor tell you what's being said on the floor.
And if I remember from the last couple of conventions, it's the only place where you can see the whole roll call of the states.
I think that's correct.
That.
Different world.
In 1996, you worked with Bob Dole on his presidential campaign, and things have even changed since then, right? In those 18 years, I suppose. What are the changes you've seen just in that amount of time?
Oh gosh, they're enormous. I had the opportunity to in 2007. Leave academia and go back into politics and see the differences. The 1996 campaign was the last campaign that I did. Mm-hmm. I got out of politics then, was in the business world for a few years in 2004, took over the Dole Institute of Politics. In 2007, at the end of July, I know precisely we were talking about the Tour de France before because it was the day of a time trial in the Tour. A former client of mine whose U.S. Senate races I had done, Fred Thompson in Tennessee, called me up and said, "My campaign is really messed up. I'm desperate. I need you to come in and give me some assistance." And so I got the chance to go into that campaign, took a leave of absence from my job at KU at the Dole Institute, got an opportunity to go into Fred Thompson's campaign literally about 5 months before the Iowa caucuses, which, by the way, for anybody who cares to know, is not anywhere close to enough time to organize a presidential campaign that's in trouble. Mm-hmm. But what I got to do there is see the distinct differences, you know, that had occurred over just an 11-year period. And the two things that really stand out the most are actually three things. The 24/7 news cycle, which wasn't quite in effect in 96, where you have all the different cable stations and they're all looking for feedback. But you've got more than the cable stations. You've also got internet websites, example, Politico, that anybody in your audience can go to today. And they can get a huge range of stories about politics as it's happening, as it's going on. So you've got that going on, that 24/7 cycle. Secondly, you have just the force of the internet, the fact that everybody has access to say something if they want to. You can blog, you can speak to people who write blogs. It's just remarkable how that's changed things. The third thing and the final thing that I found that to be the most depressing to me, as somebody who was involved in politics for a long time, is how the technology has changed. With the 24/7 cycle and with the demand for comment, it used to be that you could go home, even in a presidential campaign, you could go home at night, enjoy dinner, watch a ball game or a TV show or a movie, get up the next morning, get into the office really early at 7, 7:30, and deal with that day's problems. But you could get a brief vacation, a very brief respite. The thing I found in 2007, 2008 in Fred Thompson's campaign is that you have this evil little device called a BlackBerry. And everybody on your campaign who's significant knows your, you know, email address. And all night long, this little evil device is going bzzz, bzzz. And you got to look at it and see, is this something I have to deal with now or can it wait till tomorrow? And I can't even begin to tell people how much more difficult that makes the process for the people involved. It really means you go from being on 14 hours a day to being on almost 24 hours a day. We had the scheduler from President Obama's very first campaign at the Dole Institute several years ago, and she spoke about sleeping with the BlackBerry, you know, on the bed or on her nightstand or on her person and waking up, you know, when the BlackBerry went off in the middle of the night. I don't see how people function like that.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd here with Bill Lacey of the Dole Institute, and we're talking about everything from the 76 campaign in Kansas City to BlackBerries and the change in technology over the ages. In fact, in 1976 and in 1996, I bet a lot of transactions were made through telephone calls.
A lot of it through virtually everything through telephone calls or meetings. That's absolutely right. Then at some point you had in the, I think probably in the early 80s, maybe the late 70s, you had a fax machine, which was, a huge deal that most students who are involved with our activities at the Dole Institute come in and say, well, what is that thing? Oh, it's a fax machine. Well, what do you do with that? Well, not much anymore, I can tell you that. But so it is a huge, huge change.
Now, the senator from Tennessee, you worked for briefly in the late 2000s, the first decade, Fred Thompson, goes back and played an important role in the Watergate part of that era. He was a lawyer sitting behind all those senators during the hearings. What would he say about that era if we were to ask him here?
That's a good question. What would he say about the Watergate era?
Yeah.
Fred is a very interesting fellow, and it's been an honor to work with him in three campaigns, his two Senate campaigns, which were successful, his presidential campaign, which unfortunately was not. And he got his start with his connection with Senator Howard Baker, who's one of the great leaders like Bob Dole, of kind of the last generation of the Senate, individuals who had very strong philosophical beliefs, but who also understood that when you go to Congress, your goal isn't just to get 100% of what you want. It's to try to find out, you know, what problems are really significant in our country and how we can at least try to find some sort of middle ground with people on the other side who are also selected by the American people to represent them. So he came from that kind of traditional perspective. As someone who was very concerned about what President Nixon had done, as someone who served as the minority counsel during the Watergate hearings, that really kind of had a profound effect on him. And I remember making it very before the campaign really got started in 1994. It would have been in 1993, I think, that he and I drove from a fundraiser in Chattanooga, Tennessee, to Nashville, Tennessee. And we had a long philosophical debate about campaign finance reform. And essentially, Watergate had kind of informed his views on that, in the sense that he had a much more, he had a much stricter and a much stronger view about campaign finance because of what had been done in the Nixon years and what he saw come out of the Watergate hearing. So that had a profound impact on him. It had a profound impact on my generation of Republican strategists, too, because you really saw how that nobody was above the law. How conspiracy just does not work in a country this large, and how that if you're going to go down the road that President Nixon and his folks went down, that eventually you're going to pay the price for it. And I think that informed all of us to a large degree.
The Watergate era is exactly the middle of which Kansas City had its last Republican National Convention in 1976. We're slipping toward the end of the show here, but if you want to slip in a call at the last minute, give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or if you'd prefer to email us at kcur.org. Bob Dole, vice presidential candidate in 76, presidential candidate 20 years later, he does leave quite a legacy.
He's an extraordinary guy. I tell people every day, what amazes me most about Bob Dole is that he served his entire life. I mean, here's a guy who left KU to enlist in World War II, goes to the war, is essentially left for dead on the battlefield, is permanently disabled, is the exact kind of person that you would say he did his part. He doesn't have to do anymore. But he's done stuff since then. And what's really remarkable about the senator, if you look at his history, is since being the presidential nominee, since leaving the Senate, he's never stopped. A few years ago, he went with the president to Normandy. He's got a piece, as we talked about in the Washington Post today, about D-Day, the 70th anniversary of D-Day. He is making a thank you tour through Kansas now, which is just remarkable, and hundreds of people are greeting him. We had hundreds of people at the Dole Institute for him. He's received the Medal of Freedom from President Clinton. He received the Thayer Award at West Point. He received the World Nutrition Prize along with Senator McGovern. It's just remarkable. And his service has never stopped, and it continues today. He still goes to – this is written up in Politico today. He still goes down most weekends to the World War II Memorial and meets honor flights of World War II veterans coming in to see the World War II monument. He's a remarkable guy. It's an honor to work for him.
So the World War II generation is now fading in American life, and even the Watergate generation, those of us who were young at that time, will be fading here in years to come, too. Wonder what the next generation, what's going to be the big impact in the next generation of politics?
I think the big impact is the group of individuals who have worked for the president's last two campaigns. The 80 and 84 Reagan campaign created a cadre of Republican strategists and operatives who worked together over the course of about 30 years on Republican campaigns and really strongly influenced the politics of that time. I think we do a post-election conference at the Dole Institute, and you get an opportunity to meet and talk to and listen to the people from the campaigns. And we've done two of these now with individuals from President Obama's campaign. They're very businesslike. They're very motivated. They're very driven. They're most impressive young people. And I really think that the cadre of individuals that they built up and the style of campaigning that they built up in the last two presidential elections are going to have a profound impact over the course of years. The other thing that I think is really interesting is in 1976, when the Republican Party brought its convention to Kansas City, there was a fight for the direction of the Republican Party. You know, I think it would be really interesting, and we didn't talk about this, and we're out of time, but 2016 could very well be a fight in Kansas City for the direction and the future of the Republican Party as the party tries to decide where it's going, because the Republican Party is at a crossroads today. It would be great to have the opportunity to host that convention and see how that goes.
On the 40th anniversary of the one down at Kemper Arena, it would be fascinating to see it happening at the Sprint Center. One person called asking about conviction. Do politicians these days really have conviction, or are they running for some ego trip?
I think they really do as a group have conviction, and strategists have conviction. There are exceptions to this, and like there are in all walks of life. But yes, I believe they have conviction. You know, I may disagree with what, you know, with 99% of what the president wants to do, but I believe he wants to do it for the what he perceives as the good of the country, and I think that's true of most Republicans as well.
Well, that's all the time we have for today's fascinating show about Kansas City as political convention city and about politics nationally in general. Our guest has been Bill Lacey, longtime political strategist, and for the last 10 years, director of the Robert J. Dole Institute at KU in Lawrence. Bill, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Thank you.
You can listen to this program again, subscribe to our podcast, or listen to any of our previous programs at kcur.org/centralstandard. Join us again on Monday at 10 as we investigate our city's playgrounds, where they are and where they're not. Up to Date is just a minute away. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross, and our announcer is Linda Scher. I'm Monroe Dodd. This is KCUR, and have a good weekend.